Thank you. So, what we're looking at emerging is what they've been planning to introduce and impose all this time. And that is a global version of Nazi Germany, which is why the methods of Nazi Germany are becoming more and more prevalent every day. But I emphasize again, the people you see in the public arena, like the Bushes and the Blairs and people like that, they are nowhere near the top of the pyramid. I'm probably being optimistic if I say they're here. These are the people that are put into power to introduce the agenda through legislation and sending people to war that is decided in those levels above them in the network, particularly up here. So while they do their job, they are supported. When they cease to do their job, they're removed through various ways. And they are as much fodder as anyone else. Blair may be flavor of the month for a while, but when he's outlived his usefulness to the agenda, then he is of no interest to the people that's been controlling him and giving him his power. He's just a vehicle, just a pawn in a game that probably he doesn't fully understand. This, like I said at the start, is where they want to take us, and we're seeing it happening all the time. They want the world government, central bank, the world currency, the world army, and the microchip population. And then they want the European Union, the American Union, the Pacific Union, the African Union. And by the time we get down to what are now nation states and regions, they are little more than county councils. And like I say, the further you are making decisions away from people, the less relevance they have to the people that they are affecting. And that's the idea. And the European Union, of course, has reached the point now where any law passed in Westminster is not valid if it's superseded by one in Europe that says something different. We've got this ludicrous situation with these people that have stalls on markets that were taken to court for having their fruit and vegetables available in pounds and ounces or the metric system, even though the customers want it. Which is the level of imposition we've got to, and they just want a global version of it. This is why we're having this explosion of laws and legislation. And that's the other thing. People have this perception that laws come into force by people having debates in parliaments and then voting for them. Thousands of laws come into place every year that are known as secondary legislation for which there is no debate. They just decide that's what they're going to do, and that's what is introduced. And the only word you can think of when you look at that situation is fascism. And this is where the word fascism came from. The fasci from the Roman Empire, surprise, surprise, symbolizing fascism by the rods, symbolizing individuality, individual choice, individual expression of life, being tightly wound together and ruled by the axe head at the top. That's where fascism comes from. And how symbolic that is of the European Union. Going by the very symbol from which we get the word fascism, the European Union is a fascist state. And why, in this land of liberty called America, do we have the fascist symbols on this symbol here that talks about liberty? This is a secret society in America called the Knights of Columbus, the Knights of Columba, the Knights of Semiramis. At the very center, you have the fascist symbol from which the word came. Here's the state of Colorado in the land of the free. At the very heart of it is the fascist symbol with the all-seeing eye type pyramid. Well, you see that symbol with the Semiramis symbolism of the goddess of the French Republic. And when the village idiot is making his State of the Union speech, or anyone else is speaking in the Congress building, behind him are, on the wall of the Congress building in the land of the free, two fascist symbols that you would have found behind Adolf Hitler. Very few people seem to see this. Here, look, here's the fascist symbol on a stamp from the Nazi period of Germany and Italy. And here's the fascist symbol in the Congress building of the United States. Why? Because the same mentality is in control of both. So this is what we're looking at. And the key almost the jewel in the crown of this whole structure that they want is the microchipped population. I was asked to meet a CIA scientist back in, I think it was 97, because he wanted to get information out, but he couldn't because of the situation he was in. This is a man who joined the CIA in his 20s, thinking he was serving his country. He was a scientist in an area of magnetics. Brilliant, apparently, and cutting edge. He told me I could produce the technology that can create abundant growth in deserts without water by resonating the natural energy fields of the plant. He said, at its optimum, it's like watching a time-lapse photograph, so quick do they grow. He also said the cure for cancer has been known for years, and he's actually had cancer and they cured him because they wanted him to continue what he was doing. But when he first joined the CIA, he thought he was serving his country. Then he realizes that this whole kind of stuff that we're talking about today was true. It was happening, and it was happening around him. They wanted his genius to advance this agenda. And I said the obvious question, why do you do it? And he opened his shirt, and on his chest was this like plastic see-through shampoo sachet, and inside was some orangey golden liquid. He said, this is why I do it. In the CIA, they call these things patches. Someone's been patched. And what happened, he said, when he realized what the game was, he refused to work for them. And then he left his home one day on the west coast of America, and he has missing time. He doesn't know what happened after that until he woke up in a medical-type room on a bench. And as he got his faculties back, he realized this thing was stuck to his chest. And what they do is they manipulate their body to need the drug inside the patch to survive, and it has to be replaced every 72 hours. And if it's not, then they start to die a very, very unpleasant death. He knows that's true because he tried it out and rebelled again after he'd been patched. And he said there are thousands of scientists in underground bases who are patched in the same way so that they will use their genius to advance this agenda that we're talking about. And one of the things they do, just very quickly, is they'll develop something like high technology, like the high technology that's coming in now as part of the surveillance program, and they will release them through their transnational corporations from the underground projects. And then the cover story comes, some guy within the corporation has invented this fantastic new technology. No. It's been slipped out of the underground projects to be unleashed on the public through the corporation. And so the microchip, this guy was telling me, at that time in 1997, he said outside the public arena, these microchips are now so small they can be inserted during hypodermic vaccination programs, in hypodermic needles. And about a year after that, this picture was in the newspaper, massively blown up, of an ant holding a microchip in its pincers, and they got even smaller than that now, because we're talking about this nanotechnology and all the other stuff. And he said to me, if people say no to just one thing in this whole agenda, say no to the microchip. Because, he said, it's not just about electronic tagging. He said it's about manipulating people mentally, emotionally, and physically from a distance through access to the chip in their bodies. And he said it's they're capable of making us emotionally down, emotionally high, scrambling our thinking so we can't think straight, and also affecting us physically from a distance. And that's the idea. He said they can do it en masse or they can target an individual. And in my books, I've been talking about this for years and even named the company involved. In America now, there's a company called Applied Digital Solutions who are introducing more and more something called the Very Chip. And this is the agenda for it, although they won't tell you that. The barcoded human. This is the Very Chip. And this is what I found in a mainstream news report. Washington, UPI. The Department of Health and Human Services said Thursday that it was about to begin testing a new technology designed to help more closely monitor and assist the nation's homeless population. Ah, they're nice people. But let's go on. Under the pilot program, which grew out of a series of policy academies held in the last 2 years, homeless people in participating cities will be implanted with mandatory radio frequency identification, RFID tags, that social workers and police can use to track their movements. This is in the mainstream now. They laughed in my face 10 years ago when I said this was coming. Data from the chip tracking stations mounted on telephone poles will be transmitted to police and social service workers, who will custom Windows NT software to track movements of the homeless in real time. In what has become a chronic social problem, why people living in shelters and on the streets do not seek adequate medical care, as if they care, and frequently contribute to the rising crime rate. You're unemployed, you must be a mugger. And you're homeless, you must be a mugger. Crime rate in major cities. Supporters of subdermal chip tracking say the technology will discourage implanted homeless men and women from committing crimes while making it easier for government workers to provide social services, etc. That is what they want for everyone. Microchipped babies at birth as a matter of course. They're even now getting people to be microchipped so they're getting nightclubs quicker. This is Barcelona, I think this one is. And if we don't have the coordinates of what's going on, well, that's a good idea. I've had me dog done. I'll never lose me dog now. It'd be great. The coordinates we need are where they're wishing to take us and the methods they're using to take us there. Once we have those coordinates, this becomes crystal clear what's going on. Without them, oh, yeah, what a good idea. It's ever so good. Yeah, I was telling Ethel the other day. I think it's very good. Now, I'm going to talk about the key mass mind manipulation technique in a second, but the one that goes alongside it, I call the totalitarian tiptoe. Real simple. You're here, you know that's where you're going, but you know if you go in one leap or big leaps, even people watching Coronation Street and the soaps and believing it's real, will lift their head and go, what's going on? What's going on? Because the change is so great. So what they do is the totalitarian tiptoe. They take little steps. They know where it's leading, but every single one is projected to the people as if they're unconnected. This is how we went from a free trade area, mate, just a free trade area, nothing to worry about, good for jobs, to a centralized superstate, the European Union. We did it by the totalitarian tiptoe. And ID cards are a major step in the totalitarian tiptoe to microchipped people, because they wouldn't do it in one go because they'd face too much opposition. So do it in steps. And the idea is to replace credit cards and all that stuff with all your details on a microchip. That's the idea to sell it to us. The real reason is control and external manipulation of our minds, our emotions, and our physical state. One of the really important things for me is that all the different groups, whether they're challenging the official story of 9/11, whether they're challenging tetra masks and mobile phone masks, whether they're challenging the drug companies or the manipulation of the banking system, that we understand that we are all challenging the same force. It's so important to realize that, because down here we can get divided and ruled, even through pressure groups and challenging the system. We can get divided and ruled by not realizing that all roads lead to Babylon at the top of the pyramid. And when you understand how the system works and why they're doing what they do, and I'll hopefully complete that cycle by the end of the day, then suddenly unconnected pressure groups and challenges to the system become absolutely connected and crystal clear. For instance, there are pressure groups that are challenging the introduction of genetically modified food. Fine, great. Done by Monsanto, one of the great Illuminati companies on planet Earth, out of St. Louis. And their reason for genetically modified food is they want to genetically modify us. That's the idea, to scramble our DNA. Monsanto gave us PCBs, dioxin, Agent Orange. Yes, they're great contributions to the world. So they've had this, what do they call them? This road to Damascus change of heart. And now they want to give us the gift of genetically modified food. Yes, I believe it. No problem. Then we've got fluoride in the water. Now, when I get into the last section of this, I'll connect all these things because they are connectable. Fluoride in the water. Well, this is an interesting one. Why do they want that? This is Charles Perkins, a chemist. He wrote the following to the Foundations for Nutritional Research in Wisconsin in 1954. In the 1930s, Hitler and the German Nazis envisioned a world to be dominated and controlled by a Nazi philosophy of pan-Germanism. The German chemists worked out a very ingenious and far-reaching plan of mass control, which was submitted to and adopted by the German General Staff. This plan was to control the population in any given area through mass medication of drinking water supplies. By this method, they could control the population in whole areas, reduce population by water medication that would induce sterility in women and so on. In this scheme of mass control, sodium fluoride occupied a prominent place. Vaccinations, which certainly it still includes mercury, but up to recent times massively included mercury until people started understanding what was going on. You know, they put mercury in your teeth. I had mercury taken out of my teeth years ago, and which I'd had in my teeth since I was a kid, and the two people taking them out were dressed like spacemen. And they showed me this list of things they have to do with the mercury according to law because it's so poisonous. It's been in my gob for years. What? And they put mercury in vaccinations. How many vaccinations do kids now have? Is it 25 up to the age of 18 months, 2 years? I mean, what's the immune system going to do? It's going to come out with its bloody hands up. What's going on? You know, oh no, in America, oh no, you can't take your kid to school if he's not vaccinated. What about my children? Well, hold on a second. My son Jamie has never been vaccinated in his life. And he's never had a childhood disease. So if anyone's been vaccinated, don't you bring him to school, he'll upset my son's health. But these are all connected for reasons I'll get to later. Aspartame, this stuff that scrambles your bloody mind, a substance which pilots in the American Air Force were warned not to have too many sodas before they flew because it affected their ability to fly. Why? Because the sodas had aspartame in. They now have something called the aspartame syndrome. Because anything that scrambles the brain, the electrochemical balance of the brain, can manifest in endless imbalances that we call under various names and diseases in ill health. And who was aspartame man who brought it onto the market? Donald Rumsfeld. Defense Secretary in America, head of Sell Pharmaceuticals. He was brought into that job because of his influence in the Bush-Reagan administration and therefore his ability to get permission and use of aspartame through the Food and Drug Administration in America so that it could be foisted on the people. He came in against 96-97% of the independent data saying, no way. He got it into diet drinks, and now it's every bloody where. No accident that it was him that did it, because these guys pop up in all different places to advance the agenda. Monsanto bought out Searle Pharmaceuticals and now are running the aspartame scam as well as the genetically modified food scam. Oh, by the way, I came across this. This is Coca-Cola Black. It's new. Yeah, it's just been introduced in America, I understand, and it's got double the aspartame and double the caffeine. So what I did, because, you know, I like to help people out, you do what you can. I produced an advert for them. There you go. That's just about sums it up, right? They're scrambling our brains by rewiring and re-chemically producing the brain's electrochemical balance. It's no good shouting out, mate. I can't hear a bloody word. Maybe other people can. Day nine of an experiment to see what happens when you water plants with microwave water as opposed to purified water. After 9 days, dead. Another thing that's happening to us is we are being bombarded with electromagnetic pollution. We've got the chemtrails in all over the world. I've seen these things. More and more people have had them analyzed. They've got aluminium in and various other substances not good for us. There's a wonderful picture of chemtrails being produced. There's the HAARP thing, which is bouncing from Alaska radio waves off the ionosphere and back down to us. Once we start to understand how the body works and what it is, I'll get into that in the last section, all this stuff becomes perfectly understandable while they're doing this. And then there's tetramasts, these things that have just been introduced, imposed upon the emergency services so that they can communicate with each other, the police and stuff. Tetramasts broadcast on the same frequency range as human brainwaves. I've got one about 100 yards from me. Now, it's kind of another elephant in the living room, this. If you are listening to a radio station and it's close to something that is broadcasting on the same frequency, you get interference. The radio station don't work as well. When you are broadcasting from tetramasts on the same frequency range as human brainwaves, it scrambles human brainwaves. And when they're scrambled, the messages and information going around the body are scrambled, and it manifests as mental and emotional and physical dis-ease. No bloody need for a university degree. It's painfully bloody obvious. And it's all connected. And so all down here, we have all these understandable, great people who are challenging all these different areas of society. But what we need to understand is that behind it all is the same network of people. Now, along with the totalitarian tiptoe comes the greatest mass mind manipulation technique. This is the motto of the 33rd degree of Freemasonry. Ordo ab chao. Order out of chaos. Create the chaos and then offer the order out of it, which changes society in the way you want. This was George Bush. You're free, and freedom is beautiful. And you know it'll take time to restore chaos and order. Order out of chaos, but we will. He was quoting the 33rd degree motto. Order out of chaos, or as I've dubbed it, problem, reaction, solution. Simple, devastating, played on us by the day. You want to change society in a way that you know if you announce it openly, you're going to get massive reaction. So you don't announce it openly. You play this scam. Stage one, you create a problem. Could be a terrorist event. Could be a war. It could be a run on a currency. Could be a bird flu. It could be any problem that could elicit the outcome that you want. You then, through an unquestioning, pathetic mainstream media, you tell the people the version of this event that you want them to believe, i.e. Lee Harvey Oswald killed Kennedy with a gun that shot bullets that went there and then came back again, i.e. a guy in a cave in Afghanistan orchestrated 9/11, and all this stuff. And if we had a media worth the name journalism, problem, reaction, solution would not be possible. It would collapse immediately. Because real journalists would investigate the official version of the problem. They'd find it was a nonsense, and they would tell the people that, and they'd get a different reaction. Because they don't, because the mainstream media is just a public relations office for the official version of events, it goes through virtually undiluted. Official story, media, official story received by the people. And what they're looking for at stage two, the reaction, is outrage, fear, and words to the effect of something must be done, this can't go on, what are they going to do about it? Which allows those who've covertly created the problem, who've gleaned that public reaction, do something, they can then openly offer the solutions to the problems they have created. I've just described 9/11, by the way. I've also described the Second World War, where you had, when you do the research, a global elite that was behind the Russians, the Soviet communists as they became, who was behind the governments of Churchill and Roosevelt, one of the major, like I said earlier, Illuminati frontmen of the 20th century, who were behind the Nazis in Germany and who brought them into conflict, a major global problem. If you want to change something globally, you need to create a global problem. Conflict, Second World War. After the Second War, in just a few years, the people were mentally, emotionally, and physically exhausted. When they are doing those mind control horrors I talked about earlier, they get the victims exhausted mentally, physically, and emotionally, because an exhausted mind becomes a much more suggestible mind. And so, how do we stop this happening again? I'll tell you. After the Second World War, an explosion of globally centralized institutions. The United Nations, the Bretton Woods Agreement, along came the World Bank, the International Monetary Fund, and all this other stuff. And the world was transformed by the problem of the Second World War. Same with the First World War. And this was one of the most clear and obvious problem reaction solutions I've ever come across. I went on a radio station in Los Angeles days after 9/11 because they'd heard on the internet I was saying it wasn't Bin Laden, this was an inside job. This was in the first week after it. And they... they said... I got the usual. There was two kind of disc jockeys doing the interview. And I didn't work out which one had the brain cell that day. It wasn't easy. And it was, oh, what are you on, your man, all that stuff. And I said to them, okay, I'll do you a deal. If this has not happened in the next month or 2 months, then I'll come back on your show and I'll hold my hand up and say I was wrong. All right, mate, yeah, we'll do that. Well, they never did, because it happened. It was called the Patriot Act, among many other things. Because what I said was, this is going to be used to take away far more basic freedoms that we've taken for granted, and exactly what it was used for, as well as getting the war on terrorism. Henry Kissinger was supposed to have said this at a Bilderberg meeting in 1991. Whether he said it or not, it sums up exactly the situation. Today, America would be outraged if UN troops entered Los Angeles to restore order. Tomorrow, they will be grateful. This is especially true if they were told that there was an outside threat from beyond, whether real or promulgated, that threatened our very existence. When presented with this scenario, individual rights will be willingly relinquished to the guarantee of their well-being granted to them by the world government. Problem, reaction, solution. And there is no need for prophecy about what is unfolding before our eyes today. No need for Nostradamus. In the year 2000, an organization in America called the Project for the New American Century produced this document, Rebuilding America's Defenses, Strategies, Forces, and Resources for a New Century, September 2000, 1 year before 9/11. In this organization that produced this document were all the major players that 9 months after this was produced entered the White House and the Pentagon with the Bush administration. Cheney, Rumsfeld, Paul Wolfowitz, who was Deputy Defense Secretary at the time of 9/11, he's now head of the World Bank, and a stream of other people who have become known as neocons. Michael Ledeen in the top left-hand corner, connected into Licio Gelli and P2 and all that stuff in Italy. Richard Perl, one of the great architects of the invasion of Iraq. John Bolton, another architect of the invasion of Iraq, now United Nations ambassador for America. Feith, another one. Jeb Bush, who is the president's brother. And this guy, William Kristol, who's a Murdoch clone in America, who's the chairman, or at least was chairman, unless they've changed it since I last looked, of the Project for the New American Century. These are the people behind the document I'm going to talk about. By the way, anyone remember Mr. Pastry? Is anyone old enough? You won't, will you? But when I was a kid, there was this children's entertainer in Britain called Mr. Pastry. He used to jump around a lot. Well, I always called John Bolton Mr. Pastry. I think it's uncanny. It's spooky, isn't it? It's spooky. And I'd rather Mr. Pastry, to be honest, was America's ambassador to the UN. I think we'd be safer. Another of these neocons is Frank Carlucci. Former number two at the CIA, Defense Secretary Reagan Bush, very, very close associate of Father George, thrown out of two African countries for plotting to kill their leaders. Yes, we must stop terrorism, Frankie. John Negroponte, another man fundamentally connected to horrific American terrorism in Central America and elsewhere. Another one of these neocons that are protecting us from the terrorists. So what did this document say in September 2000? It calls for American armed forces, the cavalry, on the new American frontier. It says that key allies like the United Kingdom are the most effective and efficient means of exercising American global leadership. Well, there's two to bloody tick off straight away. Keep your pen handy. The United States has for decades sought to play a more permanent role in Gulf regional security, while the unresolved conflict with Iraq provides immediate justification. The need for a substantial American force presence in the Gulf transcends the issue of the regime of Saddam Hussein. Tick. It calls for a blueprint for maintaining global US, i.e. Illuminati, preeminence and shaping the international security order in line with the America's principles and interests. This American grand strategy, it says, must be advanced as far into the future as possible, and the U.S. must, quote, fight and decisively win multiple simultaneous major theater wars as a core cure mission. And that's exactly what they're doing. We've had Afghanistan, we've had Iraq, and now they're trying to wangle a conflict with Iran. Tick. It says that peacekeeping missions demand American political leadership rather than that of the United Nations. It highlights North Korea, Syria, Iran, and Libya as dangerous regimes and says their existence justifies the creation of a worldwide command and control system, World Army. Now, the Axis of Evil speech involved in its claims of evil Iraq, Iran, North Korea, straight off the pages of that document. It was written by a Bush speechwriter called David Frum, who is one of those neocons connected to those people that produced the document. And they say, oh, we're still trying to stop the war with Iraq. Oh, God, please, you've been planning it for years, mate. This document spotlights China for regime change, saying it is time for the presence of American forces in Southeast Asia. This could lead to American and allied power, providing the spur to the process of democratization in China. They want a war with China. I've been saying it for 10 years. That guy with a patch on his chest said exactly the same. It's leading to a war with China. They want a global problem that they can finally impose their global solution. To stop this ever happening again, we need a world government with power to stop it and an army to stop it. Exactly where they're going, which is why I was able to say this in 1998. The plan is to engineer events real and staged that will create enormous fear in the countdown to 2012. This includes a plan to start a third world war, either by stimulating the Muslim world into a holy war against the West or by using China to cause global conflict, maybe both. The China thing is happening. The same document calls for the creation of US space forces to dominate space and total control of cyberspace to prevent their enemies using the internet. What we're seeing now, and you've been following this, are increasing attempts and changes to dictate what you can and cannot say on the internet and to hand power over the internet to the corporations that they control. It talks of developing biological weapons that can target, quote, specific genotypes. This may transform biological warfare from the realm of terror to a politically useful tool. These are the very same people who are saying they need to protect us from the terrorists. Now, what else did this document say? It said that this process of transformation, all this list of things it wants to happen, would be likely to be a long one, absent some catastrophic and catalyzing event like a new Pearl Harbor. Those words were published in September 2000. 1 year to the month later, we had what Bush called at the time our Pearl Harbor. Catastrophic and catalyzing event. Elephant in the living room. Who's benefited from 9/11? That's the great antidote to problem, reaction, solution, that question. Who benefits? Who benefits from me believing this version of events? What, do the Muslim world benefit? Oh, no. What about the people who died in 9/11? No. Ooh, who can benefit from this? Only those that wish to use it to justify transforming society in the image they require. I go into this whole 9/11 thing in this book, but I'm going to go through the whole structure of it in the next half an hour or so. It has justified so much. Blair said, since 9/11, the world has changed. Yes, it has. It was meant to. The movie tells us that it was 19 hijackers orchestrated by Osama bin Laden and Al-Qaeda. The secret agenda is problem, reaction, solution. Cheney called the war on terrorism a dirty war that might not end in our lifetimes. That's the idea. You have a war with a country, you're going to at some point reach the end of it. But when you have a war on terrorism, when does it end? When do you know the war on terrorism's over? Well, the answer in this case is when you stop planting the bombs, mate. That's when it stops. But how do the people? You can sell a never-ending war to the people who are not informed. The idea that Georgie Boy is orchestrating this whole thing is ludicrous. He's a front man. He's a front man to articulate the agenda, but he doesn't even bloody do that, does he really? The people behind him, the people you never see. Cheney's much higher in the hierarchy than Bush. His father is much, much higher in the hierarchy than his son. And that's basically summing up what the situation is. Pop it on a string. And then there's Blair Boy. Tony Blair was brought in. John Smith left us at precisely the right time. How can I put it like that? And the moment this guy... The moment this guy became leader of the Labour Party, Rupert Murdoch, for the first time in British newspaper history, took all his newspapers away from the Conservatives and started supporting Blair. Well, if that's not a sign of things to come, well, what is? So Blair becomes leader, and the two sides of the Atlantic work in coordination to the goals that we're seeing now. Alice in Wonderland. Alice said, nothing would be what it is because everything would be what it isn't. And contrary-wise, what it is, it wouldn't be. And what it wouldn't be, it would, you see. That's the world we live in. Home is that way. This is the movie. This is the agenda. And we're being confused all the time by smoke and mirrors and different messages to make the truth go over there and us to look over there. And we'll see that very clearly as this section of the talk unfolds. 60 years before 9/11, we had Pearl Harbor. This was a situation where, as historians and researchers have shown in very thick, detailed books, Roosevelt had at least 8 different confirmations that Japan was going to attack Pearl Harbor. Indeed, the way the American administration had acted towards Japan in the months before was designed to make them do that. And I came across, I've got my glasses, I've got them here. Came across this thing, this document when I was researching years ago. Came out of Britain. It was called Propaganda in the Next War. And it was a document explaining how America was going to be manipulated into the next war. And it was like, next war? What bloody next war? And a guy called Nye, actually on Capitol Hill, held this thing up and said, what is this? But of course he was ignored. Well, let's see what it said. This is before the Second World War, and before, obviously, Pearl Harbor. To persuade her, the United States, to take our part will be much more difficult. So difficult as to be unlikely to succeed. It will need a definite threat to America, a threat, moreover, which will have to be brought home to every citizen before the Republic again take arms in an external quarrel. Their position will naturally be considerably eased if Japan were involved, and this might and probably would bring America in without much further ado. At any rate, it would be a natural and obvious effect of our propagandists to achieve this, just as in the Great War, they succeeded in embroiling the United States with Germany. Fortunately, with America, our propaganda is on firm ground. We can be entirely sincere, as our main plank will be the old democratic one. We must clearly enunciate our belief in the democratic form of government and our firm resolve to adhere to the old goddess of democracy routine. Pearl Harbor attacked in 1941, after this guy had spent the election campaign saying, "I tell you, mothers of America, your sons are not going to fight in that war in Europe." He knows they are. Pearl Harbor got America in the war and him in the clear. Problem, reaction, solution. 6 years before 9/11, Oklahoma, Timothy McVeigh. Unless the laws of physics were suspended that morning, there's no way that Ryder truck fuel fertilizer device could have brought that building down in that way. Not me. This is people like Brigadier General Ben Partin, who spent a lifetime in explosives and weapons development with the U.S. military, who wrote to 500 people, politicians, media people, a long list of reasons why this was impossible and why the explosives had to be inside the building on some of the pillars. He was ignored. They said that McVeigh had gone there and found out all about it and sussed it out, as we would say. Well, why that morning did he come into a gas station in the Ryder truck and ask the way to the Murrah building? I mean, you know, so connecting him and the Ryder truck to the Murrah building when he's about to blow it up. Why that morning was the bomb squad in full reaction gear in the hour and a half before the bomb went off? They denied it, but they had to admit it later through the wealth of witnesses who saw him. Why did McVeigh, when he was supposed to be trying to get the Bureau of Alcohol, Tobacco and Firearms, which had an office there because of their involvement in Waco 2 years earlier, why, when he could have parked the vehicle right next to their office, did he park it just about as far away as it was possible to do with the Murrah building? Why were all the surveillance cameras around this building confiscated by the FBI that morning, which, according to local television stations who interviewed people, said that it showed someone looking like McVeigh leave the Ryder truck, but there was another guy with him, this so-called John Doe 2, who suddenly disappeared from the story? The questions and the anomalies about what happened to the Murrah building are endless, because it was another inside job. And within 24 hours, Clinton was calling for an easing of restrictions on the American military's involvement in domestic law enforcement. And all that has been added to since 9/11. It's a process of breaking down resistance to the Orwellian state to protect us from the terrorists, who are the same people who want to introduce the Orwellian state. Now, the Murrah building questions could have been answered very easily. You get experts to go in among the rubble, and they'll tell you basically where the bombs went off, what the bombs were, and the whole shebang. What the government did is employ this company, Controlled Demolition Group, to go in, pull the building down before it had been analyzed by independent experts, and it was taken and kept in a desert under armed guard by a company called Wackenhut. And Wackenhut is absolutely, was created and has been peopled ever since by CIA, FBI type people. And the guy who runs it is a very close associate of the Bush family, indeed has funded their political campaigns. Now, what a coincidence that when the Twin Towers fell, and people were saying, "Hey, that didn't half look like a controlled demolition to me," that the rubble was taken away, indeed sold on Rudolph Giuliani's say-so and others, without being properly analyzed. The company they employed to do that was called Controlled Demolition, and independent experts were never allowed to investigate the reason that the towers came down. Why? Because it would blown the whole scam. This guy, Father George Bush, as presidents go, is as high up the Illuminati ladder that I've come across. Nowhere near the top, but higher from a president's point of view. And this whole Bush family and around him is weaved a extraordinarily effective web of deception. The guy in the middle there, in the chair in the corner, is Prescott Bush, the father of Father George, grandfather of Boy George. And Prescott Bush was involved with the Harriman Empire, Illuminati Empire in America, and he was involved at a very, well, almost controlling level of a company called the Union Banking Corporation, the UBC. And as has been exposed, not just by people like me, but by people like John Loftus, the president of the Holocaust Museum down in Florida, the Nazis were funded to a large extent out of America by these very people. The Union Banking Corporation connected into the banking and steel empire in Europe of a man called Fritz Thyssen, who was an acknowledged funder of Hitler. And the money came out of America through to Thyssen and through to Hitler. That's how they turned the Weimar Republic, which was just an economic disaster zone, into a military force that could take on Europe. And he was involved in a number of companies that were actually closed down under the Trading with the Enemies Act during the Second World War because they were Nazi companies, Prescott Bush, Skull and Bones. Well, he spawned the two guys who went on to become President of the United States and continue with his Nazi philosophy, clearly. The Carlyle Group is an organization that operates a lot of fundamental influence on the American government currently, and very much involving the situation around 9/11. And the Carlyle Group has a wonderful thing, a wonderful kind of way of doing things. It buys up companies that are struggling, who depend on government contracts for their profitability. They ain't getting government contracts, so they're bought up quite cheaply, and then, because of these guys, they start getting government contracts and become very, very wealthy and profitable organizations. Yeah, it's a nice work if you can get it. One of the major players in the Carlyle Group has been Father George Bush. Its chairman at the time of 9/11 was Frank Carlucci, the neocon who has this problem with leaders of African countries. And another major player in the Carlyle Group, James Baker, who was Secretary of State to Bush when he was president. And they connect into all these other people that have been behind the Bush administration. Colin Powell, they call him Colin because he's full of shit, apparently. Colin Powell described Carlucci as my mentor. Do you think Carlucci and the Carlyle Group might have had just a bit of influence at the State Department when Powell was head at the time of 9/11? I think they might. And of course, one of the other things about the Carlyle Group is their major, major game is weapons sales. And when you have a war, that's real good for business. Best of pals, the Secretary of Defense and Aspartame man, Donald Rumsfeld, was a roommate of Carlucci at Yale University, home of the Skull and Bones, and he was a classmate of Baker at Yale. Again, all these people connect and behind the scenes operate the same agenda. Carlyle Group and Father George Bush had a very famous family who were their clients, the Bin Laden family. You may have heard of them. And did a lot of business with them. When Boy George started his first energy company, appropriately called Abusto Energy, because every energy company he was involved in went Abusto, it really did. One of the investors in Abusto Energy was a guy called Salem bin Laden, who was the head of the bin Laden construction empire at the time. And then he died in a plane crash in Texas, which is kind of funny. If you get close to the Bush family, I wouldn't travel by air from what I've been seeing over the years. And the Carlyle Group connected into the bin Laden family. This was a lovely one. You remember the Khobar Towers? It was in Saudi Arabia as part of the American base, and it was blown up, and it was blamed on Osama bin Laden and Al-Qaeda. And then the Americans employed a company to rebuild it, Bin Laden Construction. It's all in the family, you see. It is. It is. It's like I say, secret agenda, connection. Movie, no connection, we're actually enemies, it says here. And of course it was the Americans that brought about Al-Qaeda, as we'll come to. Now, one of the things that Bush kept saying was, we must get bin Laden after 9/11. Well, he actually did anything but. So I think we need a whiff here on many occasions through the next few minutes. This is Greg Palast, very good journalist, does some stuff for Newsnight, an American. I'm not saying Newsnight is brilliant, but he's very good. He did an investigation into this old bin Laden-Bush connection and Al-Qaeda, and he said this in a report on Newsnight. I received a phone call from a high-placed member of a U.S. intelligence agency. He tells me that while there's always been constraints on investigating Saudis under George Bush, this is the son, it's gotten much worse. After the elections, the agencies were told to back off investigating the bin Ladens and the Saudi royals, and that angered agents because they didn't want what was coming to be destroyed by legitimate investigations and arrests before then. On the same report by Greg Palast, this is Michael Springman. He was at the U.S. consulate in Jeddah, Saudi Arabia, at the time of Father George Bush's presidency. And he said this on camera. In Saudi Arabia, I was repeatedly ordered by high-level State Department officials to issue visas to unqualified applicants. These were essentially people who had no ties to either the Saudi Arabia country or their own country. I complained bitterly at the time there. I returned to the U.S., I complained to the State Department, to the General Accounting Office, to the Bureau of Diplomatic Security and the Inspector General's Office. I was met with silence. What I was protesting was in reality an effort to bring recruits rounded up by Osama bin Laden to the US for terrorist training by the CIA. They would then be returned to Afghanistan to fight against the then Soviets. And another guy who died at a very inappropriate time in terms of getting some truth out about this, Robin Cook, former Foreign Secretary, he said just before he died, throughout the 80s, Bin Laden was armed by the CIA and funded by the Saudis to wage jihad against the Russian occupation of Afghanistan. Al-Qaeda, literally the database, was originally the computer file of the thousands of Mujahideen who had been recruited and trained with the help of the CIA. So the whole Al-Qaeda is an American creation, an American invention, which is then used as the villain to hide who is really responsible for these terrorist outrages that have led to the changes in society that we've come across. These two people were named by the Clinton State Department as funders of Al-Qaeda and Osama bin Laden, both of them fundamentally connected to the Bush family. Bin Mahfouz was a funder of Harkin Energy. He was involved in the Carlyle Group. Harkin Energy was another Abusto company of Boy George Bush. And this is why, days after 9/11, when people who with brown faces, never mind what their religion is, we can't be bothered, you've got a brown face over here, were being arrested and kept without charge or trial or even knowledge of their families of where they were after 9/11, members of the bin Laden family, 11 members at least, were allowed to fly out of, appropriately, Boston Logan Airport without any problem whatsoever back to Saudi Arabia to get out of the situation they were potentially in. And that was on the say-so of the Bush administration. Negroponte, He's the UN ambassador at the time of 9/11. He was involved in horrendous stuff. We won't go into it, we've got time, but horrendous stuff in Central America. Horrendous treatment of people and mass murder. And he's gone on to be head of all US operations in Iraq and now head of US intelligence. All the same people to create the right outcome. So, 9/11, problem, reaction, solution. Well, this guy summed it up straight away. Straight after 9/11, Mr. Dark Eyes said, "This is a moment to seize. The kaleidoscope has been shaken. The pieces are in flux. Soon they will settle again. Before they do, let us reorder this world around us." Problem, reaction, solution. The problem: 4 aircraft pretty much simultaneously hijacked over American airspace. And at no point in the entire time and period it took place was any action taken that affected the outcome of the events. This is in the most protected airspace in the world, apparently. This guy, Leroy Fletcher Prouty, worked in special operations in America, time of the Kennedy administration. And he was talking about assassinations when he said this, but this sums up perfectly this whole 9/11 thing as well. He said, "No one has to direct an assassination. It happens. The active role is played secretly by permitting it to happen. This is the greatest single clue. Who has the power to call off or reduce the usual security precautions?" And again it works. It happened with the Kennedy assassination. It happened with the assassination of Robert Kennedy. It happened with the killing of Martin Luther King. It happened with the death of Princess Diana. At the key time, the security was withdrawn. Why? Because if it hadn't been, the assassination would not have been possible. Now, the security of American airspace is the job of this organization, NORAD. And it's very clear in the regulations, you can get them on the internet. Whenever a plane is hijacked or loses contact with air traffic control, they have to immediately tell NORAD, the military air force organization, which defends the airspace of not only America but Canada, and they send up jets to see what the hell's going on, because you can't have planes flying around not connected to the communicating with the ground, with especially in the airspace of the east of the United States. So that's what happens, and it happens like 120, 130 days a year they send jets up in these situations. They say themselves, NORAD, that they are partners in protecting our homelands, deter, detect, and defend against air and space threats to North America. Brackets, except on September the 11th. I think the 4 jumbo jets simultaneously hijacked in American airspace might just constitute an air and space threat to North America. So, why was nothing done that changed the outcome in any way whatsoever? This is Cheyenne Mountain. 2,000 feet deep into this granite mountain is the state of the art of communications technology. These are the people in NORAD and their connected organizations that work on the space shuttle. They tell foreign troops on the other side of the world, or American troops in foreign countries on the other side of the world, where to move and where the enemy is and all that stuff. They're following something like 8,000 bits of debris going around the Earth out in space. All the satellite system locks into Cheyenne Mountain and NORAD. They've got nuclear safe technologies that go through to the Pentagon, which even nuclear weapons would not destroy. And these are the people, when they were asked why they didn't react to these hijackings, said basically, "No one told us. No one told us." This is the inside of Cheyenne Mountain. State of the art. They even say on their own website that if a missile is launched anywhere in the world, they know about it. This is the kind of technology they've got. This is from Airman magazine, talking about an unmanned aircraft, surveillance aircraft called the Global Hawk. On an early test, for example, Global Hawk flew at 56,000 feet over the Naval Weapons Center at China Lake, California. The images it gathered were so clear that an electro-optical image stands out next to an F/A-18 fighter. An infrared image showed where concrete had cooled down from the shadow of a C-130 that had recently taken off. That from 56,000 feet. And they can't find bin Laden. And they didn't know what was happening on 9/11 because somebody never told them. What actually happened will become clear. So we have these four aircraft. They are hijacked. What should have happened, and like I say, what happens every other time is NORAD send jets up and they find out what's going on and they have this plane movement sign system that tells the pilot to follow them and land where they show them. This guy, Payne Stewart, a golfer, he took off, I think it was from Florida, he's in a small plane, one of these Learjet things or something, and it took off. And they had a compression problem, and they all kind of, everyone in the plane, including the pilot, went unconscious. The air traffic control people involved told NORAD. NORAD scrambled jets, and the jets taking over from other jets as it passed across America, escorted the plane across America until it ran out of fuel to make sure it was going to crash in a place where there was no population. It said in all the news coverage at the time that the Joint Chiefs of Staff in the Pentagon, in their command center, were watching this happen. That's what they did for a Cessna with a handful of people in it. What did they do for a 767, 757? Nothing that made any difference to the outcome. Why? Because they weren't meant to. The Federal Aviation Administration, they call it, we call it the authority in this country, they have told me that it was their, NORAD have told me that it was their responsibility to tell NORAD what was going on. And if what NORAD say happened is true, then this organization has a hell of a lot of questions to answer about its lack of reaction. But there were many other reasons why this reaction didn't happen, as we'll come to. One of the interesting things about the Federal Aviation Administration is that in the year of 9/11, its head of security became Michael Canavan, who left immediately after 9/11, and his former job was head of psychological warfare and special operations in the American military. Bit of a career move, I feel, and an appropriate man to have on 9/11. So if we take the Flight 77 is just an example of the chaos and lack of reaction. It kind of tells the story of the other ones too. First of all, according to Robert Mueller, the head of the FBI, this terrorist operation must have been in the planning for months and years. Well, you've only got to go on the internet to find out what NORAD does when it is told a plane has been hijacked or lost communication with the ground. So you are these highly trained terrorists, and your intention is to hit the Pentagon. Your plane is taking off from Washington. The Pentagon is in Washington. So what you do, even though knowing what NORAD's reaction system is, you fly the bloody plane, or allow it to be flown, right out into the Midwest, like 40 minutes an hour out. Then you hijack it, and you fly the sodding thing all the way back. Yeah, that makes sense to me. And even then, even when you've hijacked it that far out and come in, there is no reaction from the military that makes any difference to the outcome at all. Some say a plane didn't hit. I'll come to that in a second. But something bloody went off there. And certainly this Flight 77 went bloody missing. Now, the story became that what happened was that when the planes were heading for the Twin Towers, they scrambled jets from Cape Cod up on the East Coast, not that far from Boston, that kind of area. And by the time they got to the Twin Towers, oh, they just missed. And then when this plane's coming all the way back from the Midwest, Flight 77, They scrambled jets from 130 miles away, the Langley Air Force Base, and they almost got there, but oh, just missed. I've got a question. 10 miles from the Pentagon in Washington, D.C., is the Andrews Air Force Base. They have no fly zones over Washington. And I rang NORAD, and I said, how do you police the no-fly zones over Washington? And they said, we leave it to the Federal Civilian Administration, the Federal Aviation Administration. So I get on to them. How do you police the no-fly zone over Washington? Because, you know, the way I look at it, a plane can be in there pretty damn quickly, you know, if you don't watch them. Oh, we react as appropriate. We react as appropriate. So you're telling me that the no-fly zone over Washington, which you can enter in kind of seconds in a plane, is policed from 130 miles away at Langley Air Force Base? It's policed from here. The Andrews Air Force Base, 10 miles down the road from the Pentagon. By the time they're off the runway, they're looking at the bloody place. No reaction from the Andrews Air Force Base to a plane coming in to hit the Pentagon. And even as the mainstream newspapers reported, immediately after the Pentagon was hit, planes, they said, were scrambled from the Andrews Air Force Base to protect the airspace over Washington. Well, what were they doing before? You know, was it, lunch go on a bit or what? Ridiculous. They were not scrambled because they weren't meant to. DC Air National Guard, the Capitol's Guardians, own website. They say here, the DC Air National Guard talks about all the planes it has, stands ready to respond to the needs of the District of Columbia and the nation should the needs arise, except on September the 11th. Not one plane took off until the Pentagon was hit and it was all over. This is what this is from a news report about the system. It happens all the time. When a small plane recently entered the 23-mile restricted ring around the U.S. Capitol, two F-16 interceptors were immediately launched from Andrews Air Force Base, just 10 miles away. In a similar episode, a pair of F-16 Fighting Falcons on a 15-minute strip alert were airborne from Andrews just 11 minutes after being notified by NORAD that a Cessna was straying towards the White House. Jumbo jet? Nah. Won't bother, mate. Another cup of tea. Now, the 9/11 Commission, which the Bush administration fought so hard to stop, but eventually they couldn't, so they put a guy in who's going to come up with the right stuff, they said that NORAD mistakenly sent jets assigned to guard the nation's capital to positions over the Atlantic Ocean. Ooh, what are they doing? I thought Washington was the capital of Bermuda, mate. That's why I sent them there. It's all bollocks. An order by Dick Cheney to shoot down hijacked planes did not reach pilots until 30 minutes after Flight 93 crashed. What did they send? Carrier pigeon? It's a nonsense because it's hiding the truth of what happened. It's why they lie to us. People say, why do Bush and Blair lie so much? I said, they don't lie so much. They lie all the time. They have to. Because they are constructing the movie version of events to hide what's really happening. Therefore, they have to lie all the time. The 9/11 Commission said that FAA controllers lost track of Flight 77 for 36 minutes because of a glitch in the radar system. It was all going wrong that day, wasn't it? They were slow to react and there was confusion about what they do. Well, not on any other day. This is what the hijack regulations say. You can get them off the internet. The NORAD escort service will be requested by the FAA hijack coordinator by direct contact with the Pentagon Command Center. If you are in doubt that a situation constitutes an emergency or potential emergency, handle it as though it was an emergency. There's no confusion there. That's what it says. That's not what they did. Now, this whole story about launching jets, that wasn't even said at the time. On the day, or a few days after 9/11, a guy called General Richard Myers, who was the acting head of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, the top uniformed soldier in the American military, was asked if planes were launched before the Pentagon was hit. And he said, to the best of my knowledge, to the best of your knowledge, days later, have you not asked? To the best of my knowledge, no planes were scrambled until after the Pentagon was hit. Now, that's immediately sounded so stupid that they wouldn't react in any way. But by September the 15th, they were still saying publicly that no planes were scrambled until the Pentagon was hit. It was only on September the 19th, 8 days after 9/11, that they issued a press release from NORAD saying, actually, we did launch jets from Cape Cod and Langley Air Force Base, confirming a CBS Dan Rather report of many days earlier. So it was yes, we did, and no, we didn't. That's what he said. Got me things in out of order here. That's what he said, Myers. He then said a few days later, we've learned that they did scramble jets, and then they said they didn't, and then they said they did 8 days later. So the official story was not constructed until 8 days after the event. Now, these three guys are the three top people in the American military. The Commander-in-Chief Bush, Secretary of Defense Rumsfeld, and General Myers. It's very interesting about their stories of what happened that day. First of all, where was Bush? He was down at a school in Florida. And I was in a bar in Bermuda after I'd spoken there, just after 9/11. I was watching CNN live. And I saw Bush stand up and say, at a town meeting, as they call it, a public meeting with obviously selected guests, as usual. And he was asked by a little boy called Jordan what he was doing on that 9/11 day. And he said, well, Jordan, he said, I was at a school, he said, and I was, just before I went in the classroom, he said, I was looking at the television, he said, and I saw this plane hit the World Trade Center. And he said, this is word for word, he said, and I thought, what a terrible pilot. That's what he said. Now, the first plane was not shown on live television, only the second one. And by the time the second one hit, he is in the classroom talking to the children. No way in the world is it possible for him to have seen the first plane hit. Next day, I'm looking through the press waiting for, my God, what's the president said? Not a sodding word. So he goes into the classroom. I mean, he's just been told, by whatever means, that a plane has hit the World Trade Center. He's the president of the United States, the commander-in-chief. What does he do? He goes into a classroom and reads a story about a pet goat. Interesting use of goat. Andrew Card, his chief of staff, then comes in, and according to him at the town meeting, Bush, he said, Andy Card came in and he said to me, Mr. President, America's under attack. None of the planes hit the World Trade Center. Well, when you see the footage of Card going up to him and coming out, there's no way he said anything like that many words. But anyway, he's now told the president that a second plane is at the World Trade Center. What does the president do? He continues to read a story about a pet goat. And now we know what was really said here. He came in and said, Mr. President, America's under attack. Not planes hit the World Trade Center. Okay, Andy. As soon as I know what's happened to this goat, I'll be right out. There you go. On he goes. And the 9/11 Commission said, response to the hijackings was slowed by difficulty getting secure communications among the president in Florida and officials in Washington. Nonsense! They have perfect communications all the time. Cover story. Bullshit. And then he goes off to his plane, which they said was supposed to be the next target, according to a phone call they later said was not true. And he rings to see how the sport's getting on, and away we go. Then we come to Rumsfeld. I've got this on tape at home. He went on Larry King Live, and he was asked, just after 9/11, what he was doing on that morning. And he says that he was in his office at 8 o'clock at the Pentagon, just down the corridor from the command center that reacts to hijacks. And the plane was just taking off, the first one, Flight 11 from Boston. And he said he was hosting a group of politicians to talk about terrorism. Whoa, synchronicity day that was. He said that after a while, someone walked in, it's all on tape, and gave him a note, and he read it, and it said that a plane had hit the World Trade Center. He said he walked out to get a CIA briefing. He said, and within 15 minutes, he said, of leaving the room, getting the note, he felt a jarring thing, which was the Pentagon being hit on the far, far side of the building. So he's given us a timeline here. Pentagon hit 20 to 10. Go back 15 minutes, we're 25 past 9. He's saying that the head of the military, the defense secretary, the Pentagon, was handed a note at 25 past 9 to tell him that the World Trade Center had been hit by the first plane at 9:15, and they'd never mentioned the little detail that another bugger had hit at 3 minutes past 9. And no one had told him that another plane was heading towards the sodding Pentagon. Nonsense. This is the regulations that they have to follow. The command center will, with the exception of immediate responses, forward requests for Department of Defense assistance to the Secretary of State of Defense for approval. It goes on to say the Secretary of Defense has to be told immediately there's a problem. 25 past 9. Well, soon enough. Nonsense. This guy, Richard Myers, he said on American military radio and television that he was on Capitol Hill about to go into a meeting with a politician called Max Cleland when he saw on the television that the World Trade Center had been hit. He's the uniform head of the U.S. military, just down road in the Pentagon. What does he do? Does he get on the phone? Does he say, what's going on? No. He said he went into the meeting with Max Cleland. He said he came out, no one told him about the second plane. He came out, he said, and immediately he came out of the meeting, someone said another plane's hit the World Trade Center, and he said just after that someone said the Pentagon's been hit. Timeline. He went into the meeting, he claims, before at 3 minutes past nine, because he didn't know about the second plane, comes out around 20 to 10 when the Pentagon was hit, and he is saying that no one told him the second plane had hit, that another plane was heading towards the Pentagon in all that bloody time. Nonsense. That guy was somewhere else that we'll come to in a second. It's all a freaking lie, the whole bloody thing. Richard Clark, who was the White House terrorism advisor, has said in a book that he was part of a teleconference during the 9/11 attacks, and he, one of the people involved in the teleconference, was General Richard Myers, who was not with a meeting with Max bloody Cleland at all, just as Rumsfeld was telling a pack of lies about what happened to him. What was actually going on, has become clear since, is that there were a series of Air Force military exercises in the airspace involving the 9/11 planes that were symbolizing attacks on America. On that morning of all mornings, this was going on under various names. One of them, or a number of them, involved hijacked planes, but one of them involved a plane hitting a building. What a coincidence, stands back in amazement. And who was it that was in charge of this whole shebang that morning? Dick Cheney, vice president. And what's becoming clear is this. NORAD and the FAA and all these other people had elements involved in all these exercises. And so when it started hearing things about hijacked plane heading for this, hijacked plane heading for there, people were actually saying, is this real or is this the exercise? Complete bloody confusion, which is exactly what those exercises were set up to do on that day, and they had the desired effect. And amid that confusion, nothing was done. This is what another thing that happened. Six air traffic controllers who dealt with two of the hijacked airliners on that day made a tape of their experiences and what happened and what they were dealing with. And the tape was destroyed by a supervisor without anyone making a transcript or even listening to it, the Department of Transport said today. It was destroyed by FAA quality assurance manager who crushed the cassette in his hand, cut the tape into little pieces, and then dropped them into different trash cans around the building. Do you reckon he didn't want us to hear it, or what? And all around the 9/11, you find stuff that was relevant being destroyed. Evidence. Elephant in the living room. My God. Inside job from start to finish. Total freaking lies. I was in Australia, and this guy who is involved in the computer system that defends Australian airspace from air attacks was with me for a day, and he told me that the airspace over the Canberra Parliament building involves a system that if a pilot enters that airspace, he is invited not by a human being but by a computer to punch in a 4-digit code that gives him permission to fly through that airspace. If it's not punched in a very short time, then the plane is taken out by ground-to-air missiles. That's what happens in Australia. What happened when Flight 11 came in, or Flight 77 rather, came in to the Pentagon? Nothing. I mean, there's no air defense to the Pentagon. They've admitted they've got ground-to-air defense for the White House. I mean, couldn't they just point them a little bit in the other direction? I mean, the Pentagon's not far. Nothing. Because it was being allowed to happen. No one has to direct an assassination. It happens. The active role is played by secretly permitting it to happen. This is the greatest single clue. Who has the power to call off the usual security precautions? Who had that power? The very people who've used 9/11 to take away basic freedoms and launch a war on terrorism. In other words, a war of slaughter. Then we've got this thing. I don't understand this. I think it's really strange. You know where the classic shot of the Pentagon is, the big wall had fallen? Well, that happened about 20 minutes to half an hour after impact. Before that, that's basically the area of the hole. Must have been a sodding small plane, that's all I can say. Whatever it was. It's the size of the plane it was supposed to be, and just take into account that wall fell not on impact, but 20 minutes to half an hour afterwards. I think there might have been a bit more wreckage about than we saw, actually, myself, if that had been the case. And there was that hole on the other side. They said the reason there was no wreckage is the plane disintegrated when it hit the building. Well, a bit of it didn't. It came out the other side inside. What was that? Oh, yeah, there was a bit of wreckage. I can see them now. Yeah. Hey, I think we got away with it. God. Now, what the plane was supposed to have done was smack onto the ground just before it hit the building. They got the lawn right quick, didn't they? Alan Titchmarsh must have been flown in. Oh, and this is the other thing. Where the building fell and the plane was supposed to have hit, I mean, here's a thing. This is right on the end here. Here's a book. And here's a computer. Imagine, can't you? Did you just hear something? But yet again, some people say it was actually a cruise missile or something akin to that. Some say it was another kind of plane, but it was very strange. But then again, as with the wreckage of the Twin Towers and the Murrah Building. I've been to this gas station, as they call them in America, this petrol station. It's right opposite the Pentagon, where the Pentagon was hit. And I went in there to get some petrol, not realizing it was a military petrol station. He said, "Are you in the military?" I said, "No, thank God, no." He said, "Well, you can't have petrol from here then." So anyway, the point is, though, that was years ago. The point is, this gas station has surveillance cameras pointing out over that area of the Pentagon. Okay? No problem. As with McVeigh and the whole thing in Oklahoma. Okay, do you want to see what happened? All this conspiracy theory and all that stuff. Look, okay, just sit down a minute. Let me just put the tape on. There you go. That's what happened. Those were confiscated, those tapes, on the morning of 9/11 and never been seen since. I mean, there's not surveillance cameras. There's surveillance cameras at the local shop. There's not surveillance cameras all the way around the Pentagon and looking in at the Pentagon. Put the tape in, darling. Let's see and we'll go away. No, we're not allowed to see. And that's one of the great red flags of this old conspiracy stuff. When we seeing or hearing something would support the official story, we're allowed to see or hear it. When us seeing something would demolish the official story, we are not allowed to see or hear it. And that's why security cameras are working when they want to catch someone, and they miraculously cease to work when the true story of something like this would happen. How did they do it? Well, I tell you how they didn't do it. People who couldn't fly Cessnas did not fly those planes into buildings with such perfection. This is one flight instructor, about two of them. It was dumb and dumber. I mean, they were clueless. It was clear to me they weren't going to make it as pilots. One of them was described as, one of them said, I was surprised you could even drive a car. And there we go. They flew these pilots. These two guys were supposed to be involved. They failed to keep up their flight training, and one of them left for the Yemen for a year. Maybe you learn to fly there, who knows. Mazawi, this guy who's kind of obviously mentally imbalanced, who they've used to highlight the whole thing again in this court case, he was described as a poor pilot who failed to obtain a license despite hours of training. So what did they do, this Al-Qaeda network? They found anyone who had any ability to fly a plane and said, get them, we'll have them. I mean, it's a joke. Arab terrorists were not flying the bloody planes, please. Yes, they were. So what was going on? Well, first of all, we got to understand the technology that's available. This is a thing called the Global Hawk. They fly this all over the world without a pilot. It's a surveillance plane. They've flown it from America to Australia, America to Europe. It's flying over Afghanistan and these places now. No pilot. It's controlled from the ground. And when I was researching Alice in Wonderland, I was watching a program in a series. Who's that guy who fronts the car programs? That's him, Jeremy Clarkson. Yeah, him. Yeah, I like him. He's a bit of a character. I like him. Anyway, he was started off this explanation of the technology of modern aircraft. And the plane took off at the start of the show, and he's in the cockpit of this jumbo jet, and it's leaving, I think it was Kennedy Airport. And he was showing what actually flies the plane. And the pilot took the plane off the runway, and then he pointed it at the first, I think they call them way stations or something like that, in the sky. There are points in the sky which the computer picks out, and it goes to that one. When it gets there, the computer readjusts and takes it to the next one, flies it over the Atlantic. Once the guy's thing's off the ground, the computer's flying the plane. It comes into Heathrow, and the plane landed, the front wheel was on the bloody white line in the middle, and it applied the brakes, all done by computer. The next thing the pilot did was turn it and taxi it to the bloody gate. Quite simply, if you can get control of the flight management computer system from the ground, you control the bloody plane. Simple as that. And that's what they do with this. And that's what they did, I would suggest, on 9/11. This Global Hawk, big thing, it's got the wingspan of a 737. And in the summer of 2001, a book came out by a former investigative producer of ABC, a guy called Bamford. And he was investigating the National Security Agency in America, which is much, much bigger than the CIA, more important. But what he did in his research, he came over this thing called Operation Northwoods, which was 40 years ago and run by the Joint Chiefs of Staff, in other words, the Pentagon. And this is what he found. This was in official documents he came across. They obviously thought were destroyed. Operation Northwoods, the plan called for innocent people to be shot on American streets. This is the Pentagon. For boats carrying refugees fleeing Cuba to be sunk on the high seas. For a wave of violent terrorism to be launched in Washington, D.C., Miami, and elsewhere. People would be framed for bombings they did not commit. Planes would be hijacked using phony evidence, all of which would be blamed on Castro to justify an invasion of Cuba 40 years ago. And this is another thing that was in this document. They were going to do this 40 years ago. An aircraft at Elgin Air Force Base would be painted and numbered as an exact duplicate for a civil registered aircraft belonging to a CIA proprietary organization in the Miami area. At a designate time, the duplicate would be substituted for the actual civil aircraft and would be loaded with selected passengers, all boarded under carefully prepared aliases. The actual registered aircraft would be converted into a drone, remote-controlled plane, their word for it. Take-off times of the drone aircraft and the actual aircraft would be scheduled to allow a rendezvous south of Florida. What it was going on to say was that when the drone aircraft replaced the real aircraft, it would be flown, according to its flight plan, that's why they chose that particular route, over Cuba, and it would be destroyed by radio-controlled explosion, and it would be blamed on a ground-to-air missile from Cuba, therefore justifying the invasion of Cuba. They had the capability of doing that with a remotely controlled aircraft 40 years before 9/11. Imagine the technology they have now. That's what happened. And this, NORAD, is one of the major organizations that's been involved in the development of remotely controlled aircraft. The black boxes. If us seeing or hearing something would destroy the official story, we don't see or hear it. Where's the black boxes? Oh, they're destroyed, mate. Well, that's funny. It doesn't happen in other cases. The hijackers. 19 hijackers. We don't know who they are. Suddenly, here's the list. Size of shoes. Everything. And you know what they've said? They've just come out and said this. The reason they knew this is because it was all in Mohammed Attar's bag that didn't make it onto Flight 11. The coincidences, that's just amazing. Synchronicity, it must be true. These people, seven of these people at least, have been tracked down by the mainstream press. They're still alive. What do they do, parachute? I mean, what's going on? And then you've got these Korans everywhere. They left them in bars, in bloody hotel rooms and bloody cars. I mean, what were they? The Islamic equivalent of the Gideons? Who were these people? And then I sat in my front room and I watched a newsreader tell me on the BBC without laughing, just a few days after 9/11, that they found a passport from one of the hijackers. I mean, was it singed? I mean, what? I'm not a physics major, but paper passport, I think there's questions to ask here. And I rang the New York police in a year later when I was doing the Alice in Wonderland book, and oh, no, we can't talk about that. There's an ongoing investigation. Oh, God. And then there was an ITV television documentary a year after 9/11, and they asked the same question, and the FBI said, the hijacker's passport is a rumor that might be true. This is a year after they've called a press conference to announce it. Why? Because we go back to connecting the dots. They know that vast majority of people do not connect the dots. They don't remember what they were told on this day as opposed to what they were told on this day and this day. And therefore, what they wanted in that period was emphasized, program. Yes, it was them Islams, yeah. So we found a passport, proof. Oh, we found a Qurans in this, everywhere. Oh, it was them Islams. And then once the programming is done, they can just walk away because they know most people won't say, well, hold on a minute. But some people do, and increasing numbers of people do. And that's how the dots get connected. Now, this is extraordinary. This is the official FBI timeline of Mohammed Attar. They said that him and this guy, Abdulaziz Alamouri, who turned out not to be, actually, instead of being in Boston when they were going to hijack Flight 11 in the morning of September the 11th, they drove down to Portland, Maine the night before. I mean, you know, was it a better hotel? I mean, what's going on? So, and he said that they left their hotel on the morning of September the 11th at 5:33 to catch a plane at 6 o'clock, which is the only one that would have got them onto Flight 11. Did the alarm not go off? Did they oversleep? I mean, what are we talking about here? See them dashing around the hotel. Oh, Abdul, get up! See the time? Knickers, pants everywhere. Oh. Then they're supposed to arrive to catch a plane at 6 o'clock. And it was all these great hijackers. And one of the things that people say is, oh, no, I saw Attar get on the plane. They've got this surveillance camera. No. Of all the airports in all the world, at this time when there's cameras everywhere, the one international airport with no surveillance cameras in its departure lounge is Boston Logan Airport. There are no pictures of him getting on the plane. This is Portland, Maine, where this comes from. And in the middle, you've got 5:45, 15 minutes to departure, which gives it kind of a reasonable thing. Yes, 15 minutes. But actually down here, it's 5:53, in fact, 5:54, six minutes to departure, which would ask the question, why did they leave it so sodding late? Well, maybe it wasn't too important for them to get on it because maybe they didn't know they were going to hijack something. And I called the people at head of security at Portland, Maine, and I said, why does it have two timelines? And why does it have one right in the middle of the shot where you at least want numbers if you were trying to identify someone? I don't know, she said. I said, do you think you could ask? Do you think you could look at the tape and call me back? She says, oh, no, the FBI took that tape away on the morning of 9/11 and we've not seen it again. Of course, that was put in because in the newspapers, that's what the framing was. It hid the fact that, as one person said, they were so late they were spitting bullets or spitting blood or something. There is no evidence this guy got on the plane. No evidence whatsoever, including the fact that none of them were on the list of passengers. This is Abdulaziz Alamouri, who's supposed to have been but wasn't the night before 9/11. He looks like he's going to kill himself the next day, doesn't he? Yeah, but that's not Alamouri. That's Alamouri. This is a Saudi airline pilot who was sitting in Jeddah, Saudi Arabia, and heard on the news that he just hijacked a bloody plane in America. He went into the American consulate there and said, I think there might be a mistake. I think there might be. But they've never changed the names. They said that this guy, Lotvi Racy, had helped them to learn how to fly the planes, not very well. They said that he was an Islamic extremist. They put him in Belmarsh prison. They tried to take him to America. And they said he was an Islamic extremist when he's married to a French white Roman Catholic. Yeah, it all fits. It's all rubbish. It's all rubbish. And the people here, rubbish, rubbish, most of them are claimed to have done. And that's why they're having to let them out now slowly. These people are completely untrustworthy, wouldn't know the truth if it bit them on the arse. And the same with the Twin Towers, again, controlled explosion, taken away by controlled demolition appropriately. When you look at the controlled demolition pictures available everywhere, lots of programs about them. At the point where the explosives goes off, there is an outward puff of smoke as the charges go. That is exactly what you see on the Twin Towers before they started to fall. In all these things, it's classically what happened to the Twin Towers. Controlled demolition. Look at that one in the middle on the left there. What you see in that building is what you saw when the Twin Towers started to fall. These are some buildings that fell due to structural failure. They don't go straight down on themselves. They don't turn to dust. And the speed that the towers fell was the speed of free fall without any resistance. Free fall speed. Why? Because there was nothing to resist, because they were taken out by explosives, because that was the classic mind-imposing, mind-programming vision of 9/11 that would be in the public mind to use problem reaction solution to justify the outcome. This guy, William Rodriguez, maintenance man at the World Trade Center, he was a hero after 9/11 because all the people he got out and the heroic things he did, pictured with George Bush. The moment he came out and said, actually, bombs were going off at the bottom of the building before the building fell, and people with him said, yes, they were, then suddenly he becomes persona non grata. They took his job away and tried to destroy the guy. He's actually taken them to court and issued a court lawsuit against them for being involved in 9/11, people like Cheney and Bush and others. This guy, Larry Silverstein, he bought the whole of the World Trade Center just before 9/11, and he put massively increased insurance on it, which is being paid out. And he said he owned this building called Building 7 on the World Trade Center complex. And he said on television in an interview that the authorities came to him on 9/11 and said, the building is in such a bad state, we want to pull it. In other words, pull it, we want to controlled demolish it. And he agreed, and they said it was pulled. Here's Building 7. Here's all the telltale charges coming out that demolished Building 7. Now, there's a question here. If you've ever seen these programs where they pull buildings of that size, they don't go and put the charges in a few hours. Sometimes it takes days to put them in the right places so it falls as it did. On 9/11, they pulled this building in next to no time. Why? Because it was charged already. In Building 7 was a state-of-the-art command center, which had been recently built at a cost of $13 million at the instruction of Mayor Giuliani. And a guy I had a long conversation with former German defense minister called Andreas von Bülow, and he has come out publicly and said he's certain that 9/11 was orchestrated from the command center in Building 7, and the reason they pulled it was to destroy the evidence of what happened. I think he's not far from the truth. Mayor Giuliani, buy a used car, wouldn't buy a new one, mate. I won't go into that. So the whole kind of story of 9/11 is full of holes because it's not true. And the media, despite these holes, continue to parrot the official version of everything. As a result of it, the secret agenda can impose its Orwellian state while the movie tells us it's to protect us. Sums it up, Anglo-American special relationship. Will you lie first or shall I? And so you keep the old black and white. You're either with us or you're against us. You're with us or you're for the terrorists. You ignore the fact that there was great grief and support from the Islamic world for what happened, because this is what you're after. This is the Nazi technique. Why, of course, the people don't want war. Why should some poor slob on a farm want to risk his life in a war when the best he can get out of it is to come back to his farm in one piece? Naturally, the common people don't want war, neither in Russia nor in England, nor for that matter in Germany. That is understood. But after all, it is the leaders of the country who determine the policy, and it is always a simple matter to drag the people along, whether it is a democracy or a fascist dictatorship. Voice or no voice, the people can always be brought to the bidding of the leaders. That is easy. All you have to do is tell them they are being attacked and denounce the peacemakers for their lack of patriotism and exposing the country to danger. It works the same in any country. Hermann Göring. And that's what they're doing now. Abraham Lincoln said, public sentiment is everything. With public sentiment, nothing can fail. Without it, nothing can succeed. He who molds public opinion is greater than he who enacts the laws. He might have said, and he who molds public opinion can enact whatever laws he wants. Problem, reaction, solution. Control of the public mind. All propaganda, said Hitler, must be so popular and on such an intellectual level that even the most stupid of those towards whom it is directed will understand it. People can be made to perceive paradise as hell and the other way round, to consider the most wretched sort of life as paradise. That's the key line. All propaganda must be on such an intellectual level that even the most stupid towards whom it is directed can understand it. Bin Laden did it. It's Al-Qaeda. That's the mantra on the most basic level. Exactly. There you go, Georgie. This is Blair showing the evidence that Bin Laden was orchestrating it. This is the Americans looking at the evidence, you know. Here you go. Lies, lies, lies. I'm sorry, that's all I can say. All my other lies are classified. This is the level we've got to after 9/11. They are harboring a terrorist and they need to hand him over. There's no need to discuss innocence or guilt. We know he's guilty. That's the new world order that we're coming into. Bin Laden, I can't go into him much because I want to get some other things in before we finish this section. But he said in this so-called video in which he admitted it, we did not reveal the operation to them until just before they boarded the planes. Yeah? Now, come on. They're boarding. Over here, over here. Right. You know those big towers? 9/11 Commission, only 2 days before the attacks, they had still not agreed what targets to hit. The 9/11 date was selected 3 weeks before the attacks. You're having a bloody laugh. You ever seen this film, Wag the Dog? Wag the Dog. What they do, if people haven't seen it, the president is a sex scandal is about to break, and there's an election coming up. So they invent a war that's not actually taking place. They get this top Hollywood producer to produce this war footage from the front, and they choose a war with Albania because they reckon no American's ever heard of Albania. And they have this war, and they get it all on the front pages, and the footage from the front is coming from a Hollywood studio, and they hide the fact that the president's had this sex scandal until after the election. And when you watch the movie, it's so real. This is how we tell if there's a terrorist at the airport now, apparently. Yeah, we've got to keep things real simple here. There you go. God, he's dangerous. But you keep focusing on what you want to focus on until he's passed his sell-by date, which is now. You talk about freedom while taking it away, and you can take 3,000 dead people in America and turn them into, well, far more than 5,000 dead civilians now in Afghanistan, and you can call it a glorious victory. That is terrorism. That is fighting for freedom. That is evil. That is the will of God to bring peace to the world. Wanted for terrorism, biggest terrorists in the world. Well, actually, bigger ones behind them. Bigger terrorists than them behind them, but on the public stage, there they are. Definition of a terrorist: one who favors or uses terror-inspiring methods of governing or coercing government or community. Hence, terrorism. I wonder if that definition includes 16-year-old ice cream vendors in Afghanistan having their legs blown off. I wonder if it involves the slaughter of innocent kids in Afghanistan. The invasion of a country that was a Stone Age country in the middle of a famine at the time. This was before the invasion. Yeah, I love that. Created by the CIA, wanted by the FBI. Strange but true. Those Tora Bora tunnels where he's hiding, they were built by Bin Laden Construction with CIA money funneled through ISI, the Pakistan Intelligence Agency. There you go. You're the head of the snake. You're the head of the snake. You're both right. Then we had the anthrax outbreak, which ended immediately. It was revealed that the strain was only used by the American military. Went straight off the headlines then. I saw this headline. Cheney says anthrax packages are very worrying. I put on the bottom, well, stop sending them then, Dick. And this is how it's done. This structure. You have the terrorism or the people blamed for terrorism and the secret societies of the Islamic world, of which there are many, many, just like everywhere else, and you encompass them in the same pyramid in your Russian doll structure as the United States, American governments, FBI, CIA. So at this level of the pyramid, you are dictating to both apparent opposition sides within the public arena. And from this level, you orchestrate it being carried out. You orchestrate the lack of response and the lack of the defense system being activated. And you carry out the whole thing by pulling the strings of all elements of both sides. And that's how it all works. And that, holding the strings, is the level we never see. The spider in the center of the web. Now the solution, more and more changes in society, homeland security, military dictatorship. We're in the same in this country. Support the glorious war. Help us find a terrorist. Tell us about your strange behavior of your neighbors. You know, tell on your friends. We want people to be informers, because we want to protect everyone. This is an FBI leaflet that says that people to watch for involving terrorists are defenders of the U.S. Constitution against the federal government and the U.N. You're a terrorist to do that now. And this is what Adolf Hitler said when announcing the creation of the Gestapo. An evil exists that threatens every man, woman, and child of this great nation. We must take steps to ensure our domestic security and protect our homeland. If George Bush had said that, Tony Blair had said that, well, we wouldn't have been surprised. Straight out of the mouth of Adolf Hitler, because the same mentality is in place. And then we go back to Babylon. Through Bush again, Father Bush involved through his son. And Saddam Hussein, he was a great friend of America. He was one of their blue-eyed boys until it became much better for the agenda for him to be used as the fall guy. And in the run-up to this war, we had history to look at. First of all, the 1991 war with Iraq, which they could have removed Saddam then. They chose not to on the orders of Father George, because his card had to be played later. And in the meantime, while they had the no-fly zone and all that stuff through the 90s of Iraq, there were children being killed on a constant basis by American bombing in Iraq in the no-fly zone. And then you had the horrific, and still have the horrific results of the spent uranium in the weapons that they've used in Iraq in the first Gulf War and in the second. Horrific things happening to children being born in Iraq now because of the pollution of the uranium in the bombs that have been bombarding that country. Then we had the sanctions on Iraq in the run-up to the second war, which, according to UN figures, cost fantastic numbers of lives of children. Half a million are some of the figures that have been talked about. 4,500 children under the age of five dying each month in Iraq because of the sanctions in the run-up to the war. And this was an interchange on a 60 Minutes program in America. We've heard that 500,000 children have died as a result of sanctions in Iraq. I mean, that's more children than died in Hiroshima. And you know, is the price worth it? Secretary of State at the time, Madeleine Albright, I think this is a very hard choice, but the price, we think the price is worth it. And when I talk about America and Britain, I'm talking about their governments being used as vehicles of this hidden force, this Illuminati, to bring about the global change I'm talking about. Not the people, there's vast numbers of people in America that don't want this. And they've taken over Iraq because that was the idea. The idea they're going to come out of it is just ridiculous. They're there because they're meant to stay there. And this is the special relationship. Blair's time is coming to an end now, but same thing will continue. Now, invasion checklist. Missiles, tanks, troops, planes, bombs, ships, guns are reason. Problem reaction solution doesn't always need a real problem. It just needs the public perception of a problem. And so they invented the idea of weapons of mass destruction to sell the idea of the invasion. Now, of course, people get, you know, challenged. Oh, where are the weapons of mass destruction? But it doesn't matter, because what they wanted to achieve by the lie has been achieved. They're in Iraq and they ain't coming out. Again, the secret agenda in the movie telling us different things. This is a leaked document from Downing Street that shows that they were certain they were going to invade Iraq long before they actually did. In fact, it was years. There you go, there's the reason. Dead simple. And there he is, he's found in the plane, look, special. So yeah, Iraq was involved in 9/11. Here's the weapons of mass destruction evidence, here's some more, and along we go. There's the whole dossier on the weapons of mass destruction. Not a problem, there's one of them. There's the mobile weapons laboratories, look, there you go. They're very, very canny, these people. Made it look like a London bus. And of course, like I said right at the start, just because you have two sides that appear to be against each other doesn't mean they're not controlled and manipulated by the same force. In 1983, Donald Rumsfeld was sent to Iraq to organize the shipment for Saddam, there's the meeting, of biological and chemical weapons for use against the Iranians in the Iraq-Iranian war. And these were the chemical weapons shipped through the American government from American corporations that were used to kill the Kurds. But because they keep that quiet, it means they can use the chemical attack on the Kurds as a justification to remove Saddam. It's all smoke and mirrors. And this is not me surmising this. This came out in official documents, I think 2002. This is it's a report in a newspaper. Donald Rumsfeld, the U.S. Defense Secretary and one of the most strident critics of Saddam Hussein, met the Iraqi president in 1983 to ease the way for U.S. companies to sell biological and chemical weapons, including anthrax and bubonic plague cultures, according to newly classified U.S. documents. And before he became Secretary of State, Donald Rumsfeld was on the board of a European engineering giant called ABB. And he was on the board when they sold nuclear technology to North Korea. And then he becomes Secretary of State and says, "They're dangerous, North Korea. They've got nuclear technology. Yes, you sold it to them, you silly sod." But it was meant to be sold to them. Problem, reaction, solution. Keep following the white rabbit. Keep believing what they tell you. And war is peace, and get a brain, morons. And as a result of it, slaughter in Iraq. And somebody told me John Wayne was dead. I don't think he's dead. I see him everywhere. I see him on Fox News. I see him on CNN. I see him in the U.S. military. He's everywhere. Go get him, John. Sitting on tanks, embedded journalists. Oh, I see them all. Yeah, go get them, John. This is the stuff they don't want us to see. The real impact of the war on terrorism by the terrorists. Every single day it's happening. Liberated, liberated, liberated. And this the thing that they're using also are cluster bombs. There are these people that are protecting us from the terrorist cluster bombs. A spokesman for the International Committee of the Red Cross in Iraq described the scene in Hilla as a horror. Dozens of severed bodies and scattered limbs. Journalists found babies cut in half, amputated limbs, kids with faces, a web of deep cuts caused by American shell fire and cluster bombs. Robert Fisk, a journalist worth the name on The Independent, described the mortuary as a butcher's shop of chopped up corpses. This is what cluster bombs do. And this is what is being done in our name, wrongly, but in our name in Iraq, and they want to do it in other places too. And somebody tells me that people that do this wouldn't kill 3,000 people on 9/11 to give them the justification of doing this. You know, if we think If we judge what this network would do on the basis of what we would do, we lose the plot. Because we have empathy with people who suffer the consequences of our actions. If we did that, well, God, how would we live emotionally? To them, no problem. So they don't have this fail-safe mechanism of empathy with the consequences of your actions. And you know, I'm sick of this. I'm sick of this bloody morality. Do you ever see this here? In America, Janet Jackson, is it Justin Timberlake? I don't know, something to do with wood anyway. He was at the Super Bowl, and just by accident, stands back in amazement, her breast came out, right? There was moral outrage in America. It's disgusting, Janet Jackson, immoral. I wonder which of these pictures is more sodden immoral. One of the British soldiers in a BBC documentary, we bomb them. You know, it's cool to me because I like explosions and stuff like that. But, like, I don't get to see the actual explosion, and that's what I want to see. But I guess when we get closer to Baghdad, we'll get to see more of that. Yeah. Ooh, yes. Support our troops. No! Support people who are coming from a point of empathy. Not all of them are. Some of them may be, but misguided in the way they express it. But not all of them. And even the troops. This is a surgeon in Germany talking about the incredible life-changing, life-destroying things that are happening to troops that are never talked about. Our boys. Like I said earlier, we will not surrender. No, we don't sodding have to. We send these poor buggers to face it. To fight on our behalf, yeah, no problem. And Henry Kissinger summed the whole thing up when he called the military dumb, stupid animals to be used as pawns to foreign policy. And that's all these guys are to these people that run the world. Couldn't care less. And then, you know, it's all the fake stuff goes on, like they pulled this bloody statue down. I was in America. I watched CNN hold a live picture of this statue for 2 hours live before it actually came down. And I love this one. It was in a place called Palestine. I think it was Palestine Square, something like that. There were the people there watching it come down. I don't think too many myself. On the front of the Evening Standard, there they are again. What? Where did they come from? And then what you do is, as someone pointed out, if you go through the crowd, you see the same guy over and over again. What they've done is they've taken a shot off the telly of a few, and they're just going to make them smaller going back. You can trust the media. They wouldn't lie to you. They'd lie to everybody. There you go. Where did it all come from? Then you got Saddam Hussein. Both ITV and BBC, in the run-up to the invasion of Iraq, they had facial experts look at all this footage of Saddam, and they found at least 7 or 8 different Saddams. And have they got the one at the moment? I don't know. Apparently, according to newspaper reports, his wife was taken to see him, this present Saddam, and it said that she arrived from Syria with her official escort and then entered the prison, emerging only moments later, pink with rage and shouting, "This is not my husband, but he's double. Where is my husband? Take me to my husband." American officials rushed forward to shield Mrs. Saddam from perplexed Russian observers, trying to insist that Saddam had changed quite a lot in custody and she probably didn't recognize him. But when you go again through the 9/11 story and old kind of Rumsfeld, no one told him the plane had hit and all that stuff. Okay, what else will they try? I mean, crikey, nothing's crazy anymore. The pig trough in Iraq, handing over Babylon. I love it. We're going to hand it back to the people. You're having me on. No way. And all these people like Shalabi, CIA, and British intelligence, The first kind of interim leader, Alawi, MI6, CIA, all the gang are there. Eh? There. But no, he's come. He's come to protect us. There you go. War crimes against humanity. That's what they're wanted for, and in the end, history repeating itself. It's just a global version. I love that one. Same shit, different asshole. Isn't that brilliant? Yeah. And that's fantastic. And now we're heading for the next one in the list, Iran. You see, when you follow the kind of background and you follow the project for the New American Century, you know, anyone's followed my website and stuff like that, you're sitting there, okay, they're now well ensconced in Iraq, okay, it's not going well on the surface, but if you want to stay there, you don't want it to go well, because then you've got no justification for staying there, so you don't want it to go too well. And the next on the list, Iran, and then you're just waiting, here we go. I know, there's a problem with Iran now, oh, here we go. And then it'll be North Korea, and then they'll want China. I mean, crikey. Stop asking questions. You're either with us or against the terrorists. I promise never to question authority. You're a good citizen. Go get them, John. Isn't it funny that when you protest like these people here against war, they bloody shoot at you with rubber bullets and stuff. This is a protest in Oakland. And they have now free speech zones back from where anyone's meeting, so you can't protest directly. And, you know, that previous picture is something to emphasize. There are enormous numbers of people in America who don't get a voice. Enormous numbers who would be sitting here today if this was in America, because they can see through it. It's not the Fox News mentality of America is not the only mentality. Far from it. But again, we come back to this. Again, the lie can be maintained only for such time as the state can shield the people from the political, economic, and or military consequences of the lie. That's why they have to suppress dissent. Okay, we'll finish this section here, right, with this. London bombings, July 7, 2005, 7-7. One of the things that you find when you start researching this is they use numerology a lot. And one of the key numbers is 11 and derivatives of 11, like 33, like 77. And, of course, when you look at the numerology called symbolism right through the 9/11 story, the 11 comes up all the time. And here we have 7-7, the London bombings. Woo. This is what I was saying. World War II, 11th hour, 11th day, 11th month. They changed the sequence for the Apollo moon mission, so the one that landed on the moon was 11. 33, of course, has great significance for Freemasons. You have the 33 degrees of the Scottish Rite of Freemasonry, and a derivative 11 is 7-7. And so it was this guy's turn now to go center stage and have a terrorist outrage in his country so he could further impose control here and around the world. The Neo-Labour Party. Do you know, I remember when I was a kid, there were still some Labour people around, you know. Now it's just become part of the one-party state in which it's just the same group of people. And we must destroy old Labour. Because it's neo-Labour now. It's neo-Nazi. There you go. This guy is in the Labour Party. In the sodding dinner party, more like. God dear. He don't walk, he slithers, that man. He does. Mandelson. And the week started with, and it was a very orchestrated week of the London bombings. Started with Live Aid. Yeah. Well, I think we might have a difference of opinion there. just me. And I've got great respect for what Bob Geldof did with Live Aid and all that stuff. But I do have a whiff of joining the club here. Because Live Aid provided a cover and provided a almost heroic status for Tony Blair at the G8 summit, that he was pressing to help the people of Africa and the third world, the developing world, when he couldn't give a shit. He'd bomb them more than bloody help them. And I see these famous people on stages, and good luck to them. But, you know, I do find it rather symbolic when the African bands are sent out to Cornwall and just go over there. You're all right, we've sorted you out. We've had a few complaints, so you better have a place because we are the center of the show. And it was a way of bringing, almost diluting the protest. And maybe it's me. Maybe I'm just a 60s guy who never kind of evolved. But I just find it, I find it a bit grotesque myself that rock singers are on first name terms and how are you with mass killers like George Bush and Tony Blair. It's just my view. I don't know what the X is, marks the spot. I mean, this is not one of the most effective photographs I've ever seen, I have to say. The reason I've used it, because that was the feel of it. There was this coming together of those whose policies have destroyed and exploited Africa and other similar parts of the world with those who are trying, they say, to help things. Well, they ain't going to help things by becoming part of the club. This sums it up. This is Catherine Bertini, Executive Director of the UN World Food Programme. We use food. Food is power. We use it to change behaviour. Some may call that bribery. We do not apologise. Empty bellies are much easier to manipulate. And we are being asked to believe that as a result of what was decided at the G8 summit, as a result of the protest, which was sod all, that this guy, Paul Wolfowitz, head of the World Bank, is going to have a transformation of personality and help people in these countries who have been mercilessly exploited for centuries. This is the man who was involved in a document that talked to developing biological weapons that can target specific genotypes. This may transform biological warfare from the realm of terror to a political useful tool. Come on, Bono, eh? Let's just have a look at this again, eh? And going on during this week, it was all going on. You had the G8 summit. You had all the world leaders there, all in place for reaction for to what was to come. Then we get the Olympics. We get the Olympics in 2012, the same week. And I'm not being wise after the event here. I said to my friends long, long before, when it was announced that London was going for the Olympics in 2012, I said, I betcha they get it. Because 2012 London, they had that ring to it. You know what I mean? I felt that. And so I wasn't surprised at all when they got it. And then here's all the joy and everything. It's all kind of doing this to the collective mind. Bang. Suddenly we have the London bombings of what was described as our 9/11. And it was, because that was a sodding lie as well. And so we had these bombs. Someone sent me this picture through my website. It's kind of interesting little pyramid joined together there. And we had the bus go off, and in the symbolism-obsessed Illuminati, you had this outright terror, bold and brilliant, on the side of the bus that was actually blown up, that was rerouted, one of only two, according to a London transport man who spoke to me, that was rerouted as a result of the bombings, and one of them had a bomb in it. And of course, there they are, just there to react to it and say, this is more terrorism. We as a world community must react to this by taking away more freedoms and more stuff. And then you had this celebration afterwards of something to do with the military. What was it? The World War II and the veterans and stuff. True Brits and Nation Defined, all fitted together perfectly. And all the pictures there, Prince Charles and all that stuff. And it was been blamed on four Islamic extremists. It's kind of funny that when you look at the background, so many of these people are Islamic extremists. They don't seem too extreme to me. And the background before they hit the papers, you know, they're described as decent people. And this is another lovely one. And make sure you get your identity cards to be found after the bombs go off. We didn't need to find them because they had all their things on them. Oh, yeah. You didn't find that passport in New York, did you? There it is. I mean, it's child's play. This is Frank Gardner, BBC security correspondent. I do think it very strange that they were able to find these documents belonging to these bombers. Maybe they thought they were going to paradise, so it didn't really matter. But it allowed the police to trace where they came from very quickly. It was a strange thing to do. Yes, it was. I agree, Frank. And it's strange how Mohammed Attar did the same. Did you notice that? Left his bag. This is a Times of London report. Police had no need of DNA evidence to identify the suspected bombers, as the men were all carrying personal documents. It's as if they wanted their identities to be known, a police source said. No, they didn't, darling, but your bloody controllers did. This one of the guys went for a Big Mac. Big Mac, please make it quick. No, it's not bloody funny. The outcome is very unsodding funny, but the story is so ridiculous, and by showing it's ridiculous, it demolishes the sodding thing. It's taking it seriously that's the bloody problem. And we had ridiculously few surveillance pictures in a city surrounded by bloody surveillance cameras of these people. And then there are other things. The bombers brought round-trip train tickets and paid for long-term parking for 7 days. That makes sense. Why would they leave extra bombs, as someone asked, in their hire car for the police to find? Well, same reason they had all their papers on them. The four men looked, the police said, like happy hikers, laughing and joking. Well, maybe that's what they were. Maybe they weren't going to bomb people. Maybe someone else did it. They talked about the times of the trains that in the media that they were probably on. The times of the trains that were quoted were cancelled from Luton into London. And again, this is another common theme. They said one of the masterminds of the London bombings was this guy, Aswat. Well, it turns out that he's connected to British intelligence, as this report in America revealed. And when the... This picture's changed. That should be the Madrid bombings, the computer going haywire. But the Madrid bombings, the man accused of supplying the dynamite used in the Al-Qaeda train bombings in Madrid was in possession of the private telephone number of the head of Spain's Civil Guard bomb squad. If you look in this book, Alice in Wonderland and the World Trade Center Disaster, there are many connections between people like Attar and the American intelligence network. What if... like Lee Harvey Oswald, who was also connected to the CIA, they were led to be in places with a story that led them to believe that they should be there, and yes, okay, I'll be there, because they were thinking it was something else, and suddenly they find themselves in the wrong place at the wrong time so that they can be blamed for something that the authorities actually did. I think there's a strong possibility. Benjamin Netanyahu, massively connected to the neocons in America. He was in London. He got a warning not to go to a hotel where he was going to give a speech near where one of the bombs went off before it went off. And then there's this guy, Halevi, former head of Mossad. He wrote an article for the Jerusalem Post on the day of the London bombings. And he wrote this. The multiple simultaneous explosions that took place today on the London transportation system were the work of perpetrators who had an operational capacity of considerable scope. And then he goes on to talk about it. Now, hold on a second. He wrote this article on the morning of the London bombings. On the day of the London bombings and for some days afterwards, the London police were not saying the bombings were simultaneous. They were saying they happened over a period of about 50 minutes. How does the former head of Mossad on the day know that they were multiple simultaneous explosions? Because he bloody knew about it. Because these intelligence agencies are connected in the web. Then there's this guy, Bruce Layton, and he's not alone in what he said. He was quoted in the Cambridge Evening News, who used what he said here in the body of the article when it should have been in the first paragraph and the headline. He was in one of these tube trains right next to the bomb when it went off. And he said, the policeman said, after it happened and they were coming round, the policeman said, mind that hole, that's where the bomb was. The metal was pushed upwards as if the bomb was underneath the train. They seemed to think the bomb was left in a bag, but I don't remember anyone being where the bomb was or any bag. And of course, there's those strange things when stations were shut and lines were closed in that area in the hour or so before the bombings happened. 9/11, same thing. No investigation. Oh no, we're not having an investigation, because the investigation might find out the truth tone. We don't want that. And so as a result of it, now more and more surveillance, more and more control. This poster, the London Underground, secure beneath the watchful eyes, we're there to protect you with all our cameras and all this other surveillance. You should want it everywhere. Everywhere as a result, everywhere. And then we've got a situation, however, when the cameras would reveal what happened, as in the Pont d'Alma Tunnel, 17 traffic cameras, none of them working when Diana was killed. The bus never had a camera working. And according to a London Transport source, someone came round and was working on the cameras that they'd never seen before in the run-up to that. And of course, we had the Stockwell shooting of the Brazilian, 7 shots in the head from close range, and of course none of the surveillance cameras were working. And we've now reached a point where a group of policemen, can hold down a fella and shoot him in the head 7 times and no one is arrested or charged with it, because they got a bloody uniform on. That's why. This guy's lied through his teeth, stays in his job. All over the place now, we're seeing, this is in America, concentration camps being built for where they want to take the world. They want to take it to a fascist state. And incidentally, one other thing I meant to mention about the London bombings, there was a guy called Peter Power who runs a crisis management company which helps people get their security in place for various things. And he went on to Radio 5 Live, BBC, on the morning of the London bombings. And he said that the hairs on his neck were standing up because that morning his company was running a crisis management simulated crisis involving around 1,000 people, and the scenario was that bombs went off in the same places the bombs went off that morning. And he said that the only difference between their simulated scenario that morning and what actually happened was that in their scenario, the bombs went off simultaneously and not, as the police were saying at that time, over a period of 50 minutes. A few days later, the police announced their bombs were simultaneous. So that morning, exactly the same thing happened as that simulated crisis was simulating to happen. On that morning in that place, exactly what happened on 9/11 with those war games over the eastern United States involving hijacked aircraft. Why? Why? Because the simulated scenario is a cover, not necessarily knowingly, but it's a cover to stop the revelation of what really went on. And how about if some of these people thought they were taking part in the simulated crisis management exercise and turned out to be used as patsies, as they call them in America, to be blamed for the real thing? Now, just before we have a decent break, once again, this famous saying by Pastor Niemöller, a anti-Nazi activist in Germany, is so applicable. First they came for the Jews and I did not speak out because I was not a Jew. Then they came for the communists and I did not speak out because I was not a communist. Then they came for the trade unionists and I did not speak out because I was not a trade unionist. Then they came for me, And by then, there was no one left to speak out for me. And what we've got to do what we have to do, surely, is stop being divided by what we don't agree on and start being united by what we do agree on, which is freedom for all of us. I don't care what someone's religion is. I don't care what their background is. I don't care what their bloody genetics is. Doesn't give a damn. They're just all one consciousness anyway. But if we let that stuff divide us, then they'll pick us off, and they're doing it. Oh, yes, let's turn on the Islams. And when we've got them buggers, then we'll turn on them. And then we'll turn on you. Well, who's going to help me? Well, there's not many people about now, mate, to be honest. United now means freedom tomorrow. And one of the things we need to look at, surely, as young people, is saying no to the sodding military. Not being part of it anymore. Join the army, travel to exotic distant lands, meet exciting unusual people and kill them and be killed. They've got these people in America going into all the schools and the malls now, trying to get people to go, young people to go into the military. Who we'll pay your college bills at least for a month till we send you off to be killed. Yeah, it's great. Hey, sir, would you like to go and be in the uniform and serve the interests of the people who've made you unemployed and poor? Does that seem like a good idea? That's what's happening in America. That's Nazi Germany. That's America today at the top. What's the difference? Same thing. Albert Einstein said, the pioneers of a warless world are the youth that refuse military service. And there's that great, great, great song in the 60s by Donovan. I stopped evolving musically after Donovan. Mellow Yellow was the peak of me. Where he said this, was so applicable then and always has been, because the few fight their wars because the many choose to fight them. We don't fight them, you know, if Bush and people want to fight wars, I have no problem with that. Shut the freaking door, don't make too much noise, and I'll tiptoe away and leave you to it. But don't use everyone else to do it. And this song said, if I can remember the words, he's 5'2" and he's 6'4". He fights with missiles and with spears. He's all of 31 and he's only 17. He's been a soldier for 1,000 years. He's a Catholic, a Hindu, an atheist, a Jain, a Buddhist and a Baptist and a Jew. And he knows he shouldn't kill, and he knows he always will. Killing for me, my friend, and me for you. And so it goes on. And the whole point of the song is that the universal soldier is the one that fights the war. And if, as they said in the 60s, what if we had a war and no one turned up? No war. It's because we play a part in the system that is controlling us that the system is allowed to control us. If we will not be part of it, it cannot exist. And people are waking up. People are waking up. They're starting to see in greater and greater numbers what the game is, and they don't want to play, and neither should we. Now, that's a great sight. I think that would be very good for the world. That's not such a good sight, though. Someone sent me these pictures. You know, what are we doing? It doesn't get any better, mind, I tell you. We're letting these people run our world, control our lives. Look at that. You know, he even goes there, like, you know. You can tell she's royalty. She keeps her gloves on, you know. So in the last part, when we've had a decent break, because you bloody need it after all this sod. I've had the crystal therapy. I've had the hands-on healing, and I've had the acupuncture, and I've still got verbal sodding diarrhea. I can't shift it. I just keep talking. But if we come back in 1 hour, and then we'll go into the last part, which is the most important, which is how we bring an end to all this shite. Thank you very much. Thank you.